Well, good evening. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, the management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and well, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please don't call in unless we specifically ask for calls, because we have this with us on the line, certainly one of my favorite guests, from Raleigh, North Carolina, Dr. Dennis Cuddy. And Dr. Cuddy has actually taught at the university level. He's testified before Congress. He worked in the Department of Education under the Reagan administration. And, well, he's certainly one of my favorite researchers. And he goes through my newsletters. And, boy, if there's anything wrong there, he sure lets me know, and I appreciate it. He actually does a great deal of research on his own, and we carry a number of the books that he has written. I wish we had all of them, some of them are out of print, but those that we do carry are excellent. We'll tell you a little bit more about that later, but right now, without further ado, Dr. Dennis Cuddy, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, of course, it's getting pretty late back there in Raleigh, but we're going to be talking about the articles that you posted up on newsviews.com. And for our listeners, if you'd like to read what Dr. Cuddy's been writing recently, you can go to newsviews.com, and there's a special section there, the Dr. Dennis Cuddy section, and pull the articles up. Fascinating information that you need to have to be able to understand the tragic events that are unfolding before us. So without further ado, why don't you pick up the story?
Okay. Currently, I'm doing this series on mental health, education, and social control. And this coming Monday, part 32 of that will be up. And in addition to this series, the current one that I have up on News with Views is called Global Integration. And what's important about these aspects is in Part 32, as well as Global Integration, the title of the one that's up there now, and the previous one, Part 31, this idea of integration, integration of economies, social welfare systems, immigration, populations, defense strategies, you name it, is a key term and a key word, a key strategy. And so what I did in the current article I have up called, titled Global Integration, is pick up on the end of Part 31 of Mental Health, Education, and Social Control, because it's a rather important statement. I had earlier said in Part 27 of the series, I quoted Council on Foreign Relations President Richard Haass. Now, let me digress just for a moment, because some of your listeners, most of your listeners, if they've heard me before, they've heard me talk about Cecil Rhodes and his secret society and Rhodes scholars like Bill Clinton, and these people always pop up in strategic locations. Well, your listeners need to appreciate that Richard Haass is also a Rhodes scholar, so it's not just by accident that he's become president of the Council on Foreign Relations. And in Part 27 of my series, I quoted him saying that nations, quote, must be prepared to cede, C-E-D-E, meaning give up, some of their sovereignty, end quote. And so at the end of Part 31, I mentioned that this just isn't some, you know, president of a CFR who happens to be a Rhodes Scholar, and, you know, therefore people may associate him with people like Bill Clinton, who are Rhodes Scholars. But this fellow was also director of the policy planning staff at the U.S. State Department under the current president, President Bush. You'll find that this often happens with individuals, that they go between administrations because, as Carol Quigley, Bill Clinton's mentor, said, you ought to be able to kick the rascals out without changing anything, and we'll pick up after the break.
All right, we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest, Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and of course we're talking about how Dr. Cuddy, pardon me, Dr. Carol Quigley, who is Bill Clinton's mentor, wrote a book called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. On pages 1247 and 1248, as I remember, he talked about how we had to have a two-party system, but really no difference between them, so that why we could throw the rascals out every 4 years, but there would be no change in foreign and domestic policy. In other words, it's all a charade, but you've got to get the people to the polls. You've got to get them voting and thinking that they're going to influence policy, whereas the policy is already prescribed by the ruling elite. So pick up the story there.
Okay, but since you said what you said, let me digress for about 15 seconds, because it's not just a situation of the Rhodes Scholars and Cecil Plans, the secret society. The Whitneys, who were very prominent skull and bones, big money people back in the late 1800s, also, and I put this in some of my books, developed a plan where they, according to them, they would alternate power, and the stupid public would think it has a choice, but it really doesn't. So it's not just, you know, Cecil Rhodes and his plan. These people network together. They often have common interests, whether it's skull and bones, like a George W. Bush and his father and grandfather, or a Bill Clinton, Strobe Talbot, and the Rhodes Scholar types. But in this particular case, Richard Haass is a Rhodes Scholar, as well as the current president of the Council on Foreign Relations. And when he was the head, like I said, of policy planning staff at the State Department under the current president, President Bush, he delivered a speech titled Defining U.S. Foreign Policy in a Post-Cold War World. And that was back in 2002, on April 22. And he delivered this to the Foreign Policy Association, which is something of a sister organization to the CFR. And he explained there, quote, there clearly is a consistent body of ideas and policies that guides the Bush administration's foreign policy. This coherence exists and can be captured by the idea of integration. Integration is about bringing nations together and then building frameworks of cooperation and, where feasible, institutions that reinforce and sustain them even more. Integration reflects not merely a hope for the future, but the emerging reality of the Bush administration, end quote. So this just this isn't just a sort of Clinton leftist Rhodes Scholar type of thing. They've kicked the rascals out, so to speak, but as you said, Dr. Stan, nothing's really changed. George W. Bush has picked right up on this, and he's got Richard Haass there, a Rhodes Scholar himself, CFR president, and continuing with this.
Hold that thought right there, please, Dennis. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Cuddy is simply talking about Richard Haass, Rhodes Scholar, president of the chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations, who talks about how nations are going to have to begin to give up some of their sovereignty as we move towards a more equitable society. And this is really what it's all about. We have a small group of elitists who want to rule the world. And the best way to rule the world is to consolidate it, and then, of course, you control the consolidation. So pick up the story there, Dr. Cuddy.
Right, and after the quote at the end of my part 31 of my Mental Health Education Social Control series, the final statement that I write is, once the nations of the world become, quote, integrated, quote, economically and in other ways, it will not be difficult for the power elite to argue that these integrated entities should be managed by a world government. And, of course, the ultimate goal is a world socialist government.
But, of course, you know, they keep denying it. We wouldn't want to do that. We wouldn't want to unite the Northern Hemisphere. We wouldn't want to do a thing like that. You know, and, of course, they're simply lying because they know the American people don't want to give up their sovereignty anymore. The people of Europe want to give up their sovereignty, or the people of the Orient want to give up their sovereignty. But the elite believe they know what's best for us, common folks.
Absolutely. And picking up on what you just said in part 32 that will be up on newswithviews.com on Monday, I go into that, what you said, and give some further indication of that, including a secret video that George Bush sent out in the 2004 campaign. I think your listeners will find that of interest come Monday. But what I thought I'd do this time in the current article, which is titled Global Integration, is to give some specifics. Oftentimes, people talk in terms of, oh, there's a conspiracy and the goal is world government, and, you know, you'll quote, or I'll quote, we'll quote David Rockefeller, or Franklin Roosevelt or Colonel House or Cecil Rhodes or something like that. But people oftentimes don't see it happening around them, and so they tend to just, you know, watch their ball games and eat their pizzas and say, well, I'm going to work every morning, and you know, it seems normal to me. So what I thought I'd do in this particular item, global integration, is show how this works. The world socialist government's the ultimate aim, and as we've talked about before, their idea is to link up regional economic arrangements and then say they have to be managed by this world government. And of course, the region that we're talking about often today is Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. But that's sort of in the works. So that's an ongoing process. What I thought I'd do is show how it has already happened, the linkage of the U.S. and Europe. And by that I don't mean, you know, well, they're linked economically, we have trade. I thought I'd actually go through the nuts and bolts of this thing, how this works, so that your listeners will get a good idea of how it's happening, and then maybe they can understand why their own education in their own community is the way it is, why their welfare program is the way it is, why their economic situation is the way it is, and so on. It'll all sort of make sense, hopefully. But once I show how this has already been done with these two regional entities, the U.S. and Europe. And what I've done here is basically reprinted an article that I had that Congressman Henry Hyde placed in the Congressional Record on July 14 of 1998. So this is like 8 years ago. So you'll get an idea of how this is already in the works. This is ongoing. It's already been done. And it's affecting all of your listeners wherever they are. And I titled this thing the New Transatlantic Agenda because that's exactly the title of an agreement that Bill Clinton back in December 21 of 1995 signed. And the way it goes is like this. We have things in this country that are passed in terms of legislation. Say 1994, you had school to work. At the federal level, a law passed. You had another one called Goals 2000. And often people say, you know, where did this come from? Well, you know, it didn't come from just nowhere. The thing was planned. There's a background to it. And it establishes a certain regimen that would be followed and is picked up internationally. They're setting the stage for these international agreements. And so what I've done is shown how on May 18th of 1998, the White House, this is Bill Clinton, released a statement at the conclusion of what was called the U.S.-European Summit. It was in London. And they indicated that through the new transatlantic agenda created in 1995, that's that December 21, 1995 signed agreement, the U.S. and the European Union have focused on addressing the challenges and opportunities of global integration. There's that term again, just like Richard Haass used, global integration. And one part of this global integration in 95 was the agreement between the U.S. and the European community establishing, in the field of education, a cooperation program in higher ed and vocational education at the junior high and high school level, and training as well. So it's education and training. And it, like I said, it was signed December 21, and it called for, quote, improving the quality of human resource development, transatlantic student mobility, and thus portability of academic credits, end quote. And it said, in this regard, a joint committee, U.S., Americans, and Europeans, would reach decisions by consensus. Okay, let's back up. First of all, note that term human resources, not people, but human resources. Resources have to be managed. So what they're talking about is managing people. We're referred to now as human resources or human capital or some other term that sort of reduces our humanity into a resource like timber or coal or something like that that has to be managed and controlled. And transatlantic, of course, means with student mobility that there'll be a back and forth, a back of people from Europe coming here, American students going there, and portability of academic credits. Now, if you're going to have a portability of an academic credit, it has to be recognized. There has to be some sort of standardization. So this is their idea of developing these international standards because they can't have people who say, well, I'm a good welder. I've had a welding training course in my high school in, let's say, Des Moines, and show up over in London, and they'll say, well, you know, how do we know? So what you have to have is some standardization that's internationally recognized, so as soon as you show up, they will accept you, or, you know, wherever you go in Europe or in the U.S. And finally, the decisions are reached by consensus. In other words, this is no longer American training, American education. It is conditioned and compromised with what the Europeans want. We are no longer totally in control of what we're doing in our local schools. I mean, you may have your child walk to school. There may be a history course. They may learn, you know, George Washington was the first president. But ultimately, these decisions, the standardization, the requirements, are being driven by people at an international level between the two countries. Okay. Now, what happened was, after they signed this agreement, U.S. and European Union then convened a conference, and it was called Bridging the Atlantic, People-to-People Links. And that was held a couple of years after the signed agreement on May 5 and 6 of 1997. And what they called for there, this was the next step, was, quote, thematic networks for curriculum development, and it further stated that in an information-based global economy, quote, governments also are obliged to adapt their economic training and social welfare programs, end quote. Now, pick up again on the terms that are used. Governments are obliged. That means the U.S., whether you want to or not, you're now obligated. You're obliged to adapt. That means change. Whatever you've got going in terms of education, training, economics, and so forth, you're going to change it to go along with this consensus with the Europeans. And it involves economic training and social welfare programs. So this isn't just, you know, some sort of economic initiative for trade. This isn't just some sort of education program. This involves social welfare programs, health programs. It's a total package of restructuring and change for what we've been doing in America to go along by consensus with these Europeans. Now, the conference final report noted that in the U.S., it was an organization called ACHIEVE, A-C-H-I-E-V-E. That's an organization, and it was, as they said, one of the organizations at the forefront of defining key issues in this regard and developing strategies to address them. So who was this ACHIEVE group? ACHIEVE was formed some years ago before this agreement, and it involved some leading governors as well as leading business people in the country. And I remember when it came out, a lot of this stuff was always funded by foundations. I think Pew Charitable Trust has a lot of money involved in this one. And I remember the time when they began seeing Lou Gerstner, who was head of IBM, and he literally said, we at ACHIEVE are going to make our decisions about whether we will locate or expand a factory in California or Oregon or where it is, based on whether you go along with what we say. And what they were doing, ACHIEVE has been measuring and reporting each state's annual progress in establishing internationally competitive standards, not just, you know, your local control of your schools, internationally competitive standards. And as I said, the business leaders involved have indicated their commitment to consider the quality of each state's standards when making business location or expansion decisions.
And basically what I think our listeners must understand is that corporations like IBM and so many of our other major corporations are part and parcel of this whole internationalist movement. Going right along with our great tax-exempt foundations, their goal is to do away with national sovereignty. Everything is to be taken over by international bureaucracy, and really it will have nothing to do with what our duly elected representatives want. Let's say Congress votes to do things one way. Why, these international bureaucracies and agreements will say you can't do it that way. The people of Europe don't want genetically modified foods. They're being forced to accept them by the World Trade Organizations, by these other agreements, supranational organizations that do a end run around national sovereignty, whether it be the national sovereignty of the United States, whether it be the national sovereignty of Europe. World government has been a long-range plan. It began with Cecil Rhodes, of course, long before that, but Cecil Rhodes was the man who created the secret society that became the Council on Foreign Relations, and that's covered on pages 951 and 952 of Professor Quigley's book. Well, Dennis, you pick up the story there.
Sure. And oftentimes what I try to do is put things in their own words. So in case somebody doubts, you know, that the CFR was part of Rhodes' plan and what their goal is, that's easily traceable, as you said, in Tragedy and Hope, where part of the group was a circle of initiates, and then they had an association of helpers, which was semi-secret around them, and they formed what were called round table groups, and the CFR, as well as in England, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, were an outgrowth of the round table groups, and even members, such as Arthur Schlesinger in his book, A Thousand Days, Kennedy administration advisor, Harvard professor, in his book, and he's a member of the CFR, said that this group, the CFR, was a, quote, front group for this power elite. Same thing with Carol Quigley in Tragedy and Hope. He used the same term, a front group. The CFR is a front group for these people. So picking up on that, what you have in this particular case is the next stage was called the Partners in a Global Economy Working Group. They always have these committees or working groups, and you know, we hear about public-private partnerships today and so on. And so this Partners in a Global Economy Working Group of the conference discussed, quote, what redesigning of curricula is required, such as what career skills are needed, portability of skill certificates, and institutionalizing cross-national learning training activities. Okay, a lot of this stuff is in edu-speak or whatever, but basically what they're saying is you're going to change your curricula. You may think you have local control over the curriculum in your school, but that's not the case. They are determined to decide what career skills are needed. What you'll probably find, and I'll digress a little here, is if your listeners are interested in education, you'll find probably wherever you are in California, wherever, that there's a workforce development board that's been established, and they're looking at your skill needs for your area in the future. And that's what's being pushed in your school. They'll probably ask your youngsters around eighth grade to choose a career path. Now, in case you object and say, well, I don't want my child locked in to, you know, being an electrician or something, they will say, and truthfully, well, you know, you're not locked in, you can change. The problem is, and this is what the German students found out, is once you go through a couple of years of whatever path, track you're in, then it becomes really difficult to change and graduate on time because you have to have certain course requirements. Let's say you take, you know, your freshman and take electrician one, and then sophomore year take electrician two, and then you say, well, I don't want to be an electrician, I want to be a welder or something. Well, you know, then you've got to start all over. You've got to take welding one and welding two and so on. And so that can actually delay your graduation. And so what in Germany they found was that the youngster, once they got into a career path, they stayed in there even though they really didn't want to because they wanted to graduate on time. And so what you have here is the determination on what career skills are needed, and you have the portability of the skill certificates. So in addition to this workforce development board, what you'll probably find, and you can check this out at your local high school, you'll probably find now that your graduates either have on their diploma or on some you know, piece of paper that they have a skill certificate. Now, you could be college prep, but most youngsters entering school do not get a four-year college education.
Hold that thought right there, Dennis. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty and bring our other stations on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and we're covering the information he has posted up on newswithviews.com. And he's talking about this workforce education, which is being, of course, disseminated not only here in the United States, but throughout Europe. And eventually, of course, it will be disseminated throughout the world. But right now, certainly the United States and Europe, and the idea that people will be trained in certain specific trades, and they will be trained to certain specific standards so that they will be able to work in the United States or, you know, in France or Italy or Germany, or because they're going to have certificates that are issued by the academic facilities, and of course they're going to say this man is to be a welder, and the thing is that you get into welding, that's what you'll do the rest of your life. It's all being planned by the bureaucracy. We need welders, we train welders. We need street sweepers, we train streepers. We need nurses. We train nurses. You want to be a doctor? Sorry, we don't need doctors. We need nurses now, and specifically in this area. So wouldn't you like to become a nurse? Go ahead, Dennis.
Sure. That's right. And, two points then. Previously, you had mentioned about corporations and their role in all this driving. And I remember hearing, just as an aside, back in the 1970s, and this was, you know, a long time ago, and I remember they looked, it was an interview in Oklahoma, I think it was Oklahoma City or Tulsa, and they were interviewing the head of Phillips Petroleum, it was called at the time. And the fellow was saying, you know, what about this, that, and the other, and the price of gasoline, and there's a gas shortage here in the 70s, and why don't you do this, that, and the other? And the head of Phillips Petroleum just looked right at him and right in the camera and said, oh, but we can't consider America. We're an international company. We have to think of our global responsibilities. We can't just think of Americans and what we're doing here. And so I got the idea early on, 35 years or so ago, that these major corporations were really going global. A lot of their profits were coming from overseas, and the bottom line is what they cared about, and if it didn't go along with the best interest of American workers, well, that's, you know, that's just too bad.
And, of course, that's why they don't see anything wrong with transferring, you know, so many of their jobs over to India, and you want to, for instance, arrange a flight on Delta Airlines. Why, you call in, you'll talk to a computer, and then you'll be transferred to Raj, who's over in New Delhi, or certainly somebody else over in one of the other Indian communities. And increasing, our major corporations are transferring their telephone communications overseas. They're transferring many of our better jobs overseas. They're transferring our factories overseas. It is all about internationalism. It's doing away with sovereignty. It's redistribution of the wealth and the jobs and the manufacturing of the United States to other countries to raise their living standards and lower ours. And the average American just can't understand anything that's going on. It just doesn't make sense. Well, of course it makes sense. In the same way that the administration and all the administrations have refused to enforce the immigration laws. They want people coming in. They want to lower the wage standards. They want to break the backs of the unions. They want to begin raising American living standards to that of the Mexican peasant. It's happening before our very eyes, and the average American has no ideas what's happening. And, of course, Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity will keep telling us that everything's all right. Why, there's nothing wrong with the Council on Foreign Relations. Just a group of people who sit around and the boring meetings, terrible boring meetings, but never mention this is a front organization for a secret society. And you want to document it, to read the book written by Professor Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's mentor, so effective that somebody bought up the publisher and destroyed the plates of the first half of Tragedy and Hope. And if you don't believe that, we have an interview with Professor Quigley where he tells you that story, how they bought up his publisher, destroyed the plates of the first half of his book, so the American people would never know the truth. Well, go ahead, Dennis.
Yeah, that Washington Post interview, or after he did that, the article that he wrote following the interview with Professor Quigley was titled, quote, "The Professor Who Knew Too Much," was the title of that. I think Quigley passed away about a year after that. And I've had a similar experience as you did with Delta. I mean, not with Delta, but I think it was Sprint Telephone Company, whatever it was. And I could clearly hear that this is a voice of someone from India, but he didn't call himself Raj. He said, "This is John." I mean, he made a big point of saying, "This is John." So that you would think it's down the street from you, or your local fellow resident there. And, there's three aspects to an economy. You have your manufacturing base, which is extremely important because it's necessary in times of hardship or war or whatever to control your own vital industries, you know, whatever widgets or airplane parts or whatever you need. Another part, I guess we'll pick up after the break.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back here with Dr. Dennis Cuddy. And, of course, we're talking about this move towards globalization, the move towards the end of sovereignty, the move towards the end of our constitutional guarantees of freedom. The end of America as we know it. And it's well on the way, ladies and gentlemen, well on the way. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and people say, well, if these things were going on, certainly we'd read about it in the newspapers or the magazines, or we'd hear about it on television, and people do not understand that Cecil Rhodes and his right-hand man, Lloyd Milner, were talking back in the, you know, in the 1890s about, you know, the importance of gaining control of the media. And, of course, many generations later, we're, what, five generations later, why, it is these people of great wealth, the disciples of Cecil Rhodes and Lloyd Milner, who today control the major media in the United States and really certainly here in the North American hemisphere. And it's because they have the control of the major media, 90 to 95% of the major media, is in the hands of five mega corporations that determine largely what the American people hear, read, and see. And that is how they're able to mold our minds, to create our tastes, to suggest our ideas. And they're suggested primarily by people we have never even heard of. Go ahead.
Sure. And basically, before the break, we were talking about corporations, and David Corton has a book about corporations are ruling the world. And they're, they and the foundations and the big money people, for example, the CFR is an outgrowth of Cecil Rhodes' plan. You have to have money. And so J.P. Morgan put up a lot of the money for the Council on Foreign Relations operations in its early days, with his right-hand man, Thomas Lamont, and others. And originally they were going to buy up about 200 newspapers, but then they got, I think the guy's name was Sibley, they found out he was the sort of conduit. You know, he would take Morgan's money around and, slip it into people's pockets. And, they found out they really only had to buy up about 25 papers because all the other papers around the country would get their information from them. So, what I do is I ask people today, same thing could have been done 50 years or so ago, is, well, did you hear that Woodrow Wilson said there's a power somewhere so complete, so pervasive, so interlocked, so watchful, and so forth and so on, and FDR said the financial element owns our country, and so forth, and they say, well, no, I hadn't heard that, and I say, well, why is it you think that these newspapers, the New York Times, Washington Post, and all, haven't told you about this? This isn't some, you know, wild-eyed extremist. This is the presidents of the United States. And then they get an idea that it's not just what they're told in the newspaper, but as you said, what the newspapers keep them from knowing, what they deliberately don't tell them. And so what you have, just before the break, I was saying there's three aspects to an economy. You have your manufacturing base, which we've already shipped overseas.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, as Dr. Dennis Kenny, and he says there's three elements to an economy, the manufacturing, and well, we're shipping that overseas. We're closing down. Ford's going to close down a number of its major plants and move them down to Mexico, lay the people off here, and just simply shift its manufacturing base to Mexico. That's certainly General Motors doing that. The largest automobile manufacturer in China today is not Chinese Motors. It's not Nissan or one of the other. It's General Motors, the largest automobile manufacturer in China. But we can't let the American people know that as we're shutting down General Motors plants. So pick the story up there, Dennis.
So it's not just a matter of shipping, quote, jobs overseas. Oftentimes what happens is we ship our technology over there and then arbitrage the workers. We're just substituting these, you know, Chinese workers for American workers and giving them the American technology with which to undermine the American worker. And so the three aspects of the workforce, the labor force, would be your manufacturing jobs. They went started overseas a long time ago. Pretty much all of it's gone. I mean, you can't get a shirt made in the USA anymore, practically here, as well as a lot of other things. And I sometimes give that sort of humorous story about this fellow named John Smith wakes up and he turns on his radio made in Singapore and shaves himself with a razor made in Japan and puts on his shirt made in Hong Kong and so forth, and then he goes out and looks for a good paying American job and he's really, you know, surprised. I don't know why I can't find one when he's, you know, been buying all the time products that have been made overseas, manufactured. But when they went overseas, we told, well, don't worry about that because we'll have these high-tech, high-paying, innovative jobs. You know, that's where America's strength is with innovation and so on and so on. But now we find out that a lot of those are being outsourced overseas to other countries. A lot of even hospitals' x-rays are being read overnight in India, and then the results shipped back, you know, the next morning for the doctors at Hospital X here to use. Or if they don't do that, the Bush administration is trying to increase the number of, I think it's called H-1B visas, where they actually bring these highly skilled technicians from overseas to this country.
And, of course, they'll work for a much lower sum of money, and they want to increase that to $175,000 a year. 175,000 immigrants coming in with these special visas, and, of course, that's simply going to put, you know, American workers out of work, and that's what it's about. American workers are going to be forced to work for less, and we're going to grind down the wage standards in America. They know what they're doing, but they can't tell the American people.
Right, and I think the Bush administration wants to almost double that number that they can get in here with these visas. And so what we're left with is the third tier of labor force, which are your service workers. And in that, we're being undercut as well. And that involves oftentimes youngsters starting out, African Americans or white or whatever, you know, just 18 years old starting in the workforce. Because, as I indicated earlier, most people who start school in the kindergarten, the first grade, do not wind up getting four-year college degrees. And so they're into some sort of occupation, welding, electrician, whatever. And in this particular case, in service industries, whether it's hotel, motel workers, or if they're in orderlies in hospitals, or beside that, grass cutters, carpet cleaners, all of these industries, what's happened is guest workers are moving in and are able to live, literally live, off of minimum wage because the contractors are getting, let's say, 10 of them and housing them in a house like a dormitory, just, you know, cramming 10 of them into a three-bedroom house so that they have to pay individually only one-tenth of the cost, whether it's a utility bill or, you know, water, whatever the bill is, electricity, that the average young person, let's say an 18-year-old American who wants to start a family, work real hard, they have to pay or bear all of that burden themselves. But these people brought in as guest workers can literally live on minimum wage when the American young American worker cannot do that. And so we're getting whacked here in terms of manufacturing jobs and high-tech jobs and service industry jobs as well. And so this is part of a long-term plan. And as I indicated, this agreement, this new transatlantic agenda, it was called, what you have is school to work was the initiatives there, as well as the national standards that we have for Goals 2000 were developed by the National Center on Education and the Economy. The fellow who's head of that is a Mark Tucker. He was in where I used to work in the federal government, and when I came, he left, and he went to this organization. It's a Carnegie product, Carnegie idea, Carnegie funded. Actually, this fellow who was governor of my state, it was his brainchild, more or less. He went up to talk to David Hamburg with Carnegie and got him to do this. But anyway, Mark Tucker was with this National Center on Education Economy, and Hillary was on the board, and the governor of this state was on the board, and David Rockefeller Jr. was on the board, and Mario Cuomo was on. Everybody seems to be on this board. And one of the people also on the National Skills Standards Board, they're setting these skill standards, is Carolyn Warner, who used to be the superintendent of Arizona schools. And I have a quote of her back in the Arizona Republic newspaper in the 1970s, where she says that teachers are to be honored more than parents, because parents just have the children, but teachers teach them the art of living. That's that typical elitist mentality. And so what the Skills Standards Board on its website says, they're developing what's called a smart card. They had a smart cards project forum. And in there, the forum, it says, quote, the Tavistock Institute, the European Commission, are working on a feasibility study to research the effect of using smart cards in competence accreditation. The study will be carried out in the USA and parts of Europe. Now, I'm not going to go into Tavistock. We've talked about them in the past, but that's a really interesting outfit and their theories of social turbulence and John Rawlings Rees and his psychological manipulation, and said, you know, we're getting into schools and religion and we're taking them over, and and infiltrating them and so on. But anyway, the point is they're developing this smart card for competence accreditation. In other words, you have to be accredited. You have to go to accredited school to determine that you are now competent as a welder and electrician. And all of this is going to be stuck on this smart card that Tavistock has developed. And the project involved assessing and validating the student's skills, and it would put this information, their personal skills, on these smart cards. And what I thought was an interesting phrase is where it said these will become, these smart cards, these skill competency notations on the skill passport, skill card, would become real passports to employment. That's the term they use. They would become real passports to employment. And so what I asked in this article that I wrote was, if without a passport one cannot enter a country, does this mean that without a skills passport one may not be able to get a job in the future? This is one of the ways that they proceed with these things. They'll attach accreditation or certification requirements, and you have to jump through certain hoops, or you wind up not getting into college or not getting a job. And so in October of 1997, the Tavistock Institute and Manchester University over in England completed a final report for the European Commission. And they in there described the relevancy of, in the U.S., Goals 2000, SCANS, that's the U.S. Department of Labor's Secretary of Labor's Commission on Achieving Necessary Skills, typology with its, quote, profound implications for the curriculum and training changes that this will require, end quote. Now, let me digress, because one example I like to give of this SCANS report is, this was Bill Brock, he was senator then, and, you know, the Secretary of Labor was involved in this. A lot of high-level people are going to be putting down your competence and all these skills. And so I got the book. I got the SCANS report. And in there, they have everything under the sun. They have, you know, manure handling for farmers and so on. And one of the skills that these people have, these geniuses say, is that the way you feed cows is by attaching milkers. These are milking machines. You attach the milking machine. Any of you are familiar with farming? Milkers are called, the milking machines are called milkers. And so they say, these geniuses say, the way you feed cows is by attaching these milking machines to them. And these are the people who are going to decide what competencies we should have, what skills we should have in order to get these passports to employment. And so what they did was they determined what valid skill standards there would be. They wanted these portable credentials, and they said they would be, quote, benchmark to international standards such as those promulgated by the International Standards Organization, ISO, end quote. Now, in case you're not familiar, listeners, with ISO, that was originated back in the late 1940s, and they standardize everything, the size of cartons, the size of shipping devices, weighing machines. Everything has this ISO standard number on it. And so this, too, we're going to have benchmark to international standards such as those promulgated by that. So now your educational standards are going to be as well. And remember, this isn't just education. This involves your social welfare programs you have to adapt that I told you about earlier. And the report summary goes on to say that, quote, there is increasing attention being focused on developing global skill standards and accreditation requirements. And there will be, quote, partnerships between government, industry, and representatives of worker organizations and a high degree of integration, there's that term again, integration, embedding skills within the broader context of economic and social activity, and specifically within the areas of secondary education, work-based learning, and local and regional economic development. And it goes on talking about the Skills Standards Board's Goals 2000, School to Work, are all coming to act as a catalyst to promote the formation of partnerships to develop skill standards. In this regard, a system like O-Net, O and then N-E-T, can be seen as the glue that holds everything together, end quote. Now, that's a long quotation, but the key words are, these are going to be international skill standards, internationally accredited. You're going to have partnerships. You may have heard public-private partnerships. It's going to be between government and industry and worker organizations. You're going to have these integrated, there's that term again, integration. They're going to embed the skills within a broader context, not just education, but the broader context of economic and social activity. in your secondary education, work-based learning, and regional economic development for your region, wherever you are, the Western U.S., Southern U.S., whatever. And so they have to have something to hold this all together. This is a very large system. And so ONET, it's a organization that was formed, is going to hold all this together. Now, your listeners probably, again, never heard of ONET. You know, what's an ONET? Well, ONET, and I'm writing this, remember, I'm writing this as a congressional record back 8 years ago. ONET is a new occupational database system sponsored by the U.S. Department of Labor's Employment and Training Administration. And at that time, 8-plus years ago, it was being piloted in Texas, South Carolina, California, New York, and Minnesota. And what it includes is information like, quote, worker characteristics, that's your abilities, interests, work styles, and so on, as well as, quote, worker requirements, and that's your basic skills, knowledge, and education. So this is a total package. Everything is going to be determined, accredited by consensus. You're going to have to do these to get a job. You're going to have portability of skill credentials. There is a database already in the works that has all of your records, and this whole ball of wax has been planned and organized and in the works, and most people aren't even aware of it.
And I think this is the thing. It's all incremental. They do it so slowly. We really don't understand what's happening. They have a plan. They have an agenda, and they follow it step by step. You know, who would have imagined, you know, that they would have all the rules and regulations as far as the environment is concerned, and you can't develop your land if you have a fern on it because this might be a wet zone, or you may have a snail on it. How did all of these things come about? Certainly the American people didn't vote on it. Our duly elected representatives didn't vote on it. It was all just brought in through a massive bureaucracy, and this is what they're doing. They're doing an end run around our constitutional guarantees of freedom, because there are people who really don't believe in freedom. They believe in a new world order under a ruling aristocracy, and that's them, because they're so much smarter than we are. And then, of course, along with that, of course, will be the destruction of conventional Christianity and replacing it with some sort of a new type of religion. Because it all goes together. You cannot separate this move towards the one-world dictatorship under a ruling elite. And, of course, the spiritual force that energizes them. Why don't you pick up there, Dennis?
Sure. And the point I want to make is this article that I had is in Global Integration, the current one I have on News with Views. I wrote this. It was put in the congressional record by Congressman Henry Hyde 8 years ago. And at that same time, this example is the U.S. and Europe. But you'd have works, all your listeners are familiar with John Naisbitt. At that time, 96, he was writing Megatrends Asia. It's not just the U.S. and Europe. All of these regional economic arrangements, in this case, Naisbitt's writing about Asia, and he says the cultural changes transforming Asia and how the rest of the world will be affected in the next century. All of these are going to be linked up. Economically will be the primary force, but part of that will be education and so on. And the elite are all for this, and that you mentioned Carol Quigley in his book Tragedy and Hope. This was not an expose in a negative sense. As far as Quigley was concerned, he had access to the, quote, secret records of these people for a couple of years in the early 60s. He got a few of them from Lord Haldane, a few from Lord Milner, and one or two other people, and when he titled his book Tragedy and Hope, he thought these people were the hope of the world. It was a positive thing. He said their importance is so great that they need to be known. He thought he was doing, you know, them a big favor by saying, look, you know, these people are great, they need credit for this, and we need to recognize their expertise and their guidance and how wonderful they are. And that's why he was able to get a hold of these, quote, secret records. It wasn't like there was an infiltrator within Cecil Rhodes' outfit saying, you know, I object to this, you know, and I'm going to expose it. Quigley was able to get these things because he thought they were wonderful. They were the hope of the world. And he just wanted to give them credit and recognition for this.
No, but of course, they did not want credit and recognition.
No.
Not publicly. The last thing they wanted was for us common folks to understand what they were up to.
That's right. But people like Sir Alfred Zimmern was, I guess, the main one funneling a lot of this stuff to him. A few of them, and Quigley didn't, you know, he didn't appreciate the fact, and Quigley later in his life sort of wised up to the fact that they they didn't like what he did. But as you said, there's also a spiritual element. Quigley doesn't get so much into that, but there is the spiritual element, which had been part of that. I remember the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, Henry Kissinger had worked for him in the 50s. David Rockefeller picked up Kissinger and sort of groomed him as a young Harvard PhD type. And the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, for which Kissinger worked in the late 50s, produced a mid-century challenge, it was called. And in there, they talked about the New World Order. They used that term, New World Order, and they said it wouldn't just be political, economic, and social. There would be a spiritual element to it as well. So they recognized that there is a certain spiritual aspect to this thing that they cannot allow to go forward by chance. They have to control that as well.
And, of course, when you read what Barry Goldwater wrote about the Trilateral Commission, which is sort of a little step above the Council on Foreign Relations organized by David Rockefeller, and, of course, there, Barry Goldwater recognized they not only wanted to control political and banking, but ecclesiastic, he was talking about. They wanted to control the church because they knew that was how they could control the people. Well, Dennis, why don't you go right ahead? We've got about 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
Okay, and that's important. Goldwater was explaining the CFR, and in this case, the Trilateral Commission, in his book With No Apologies, was Barry Goldwater's book, and he used that term, ecclesiastical. And remember I mentioned before about Tavistock and John Rawlings Rees, and in one of the parts of my mental health education social control series, I quote, in fact, one of the early parts, John Rawlings Rees from a mental health journal that he authored an article in, and he just flat out said, you know, we are getting into the church, the religious aspect of life, as well as education. And he says we're already in there. We've infiltrated. He was a psychiatrist. We've infiltrated them, and we're going to control and manipulate them. And so early on, they were already in there, and they had cooperative elements. You had people like John Foster Dulles, who would later, after 1940, when Rees is writing this, I think it was 40, maybe 41, who was part of, Dulles was part of what's called the Universal World Brotherhood. He would go to these syncretistic interfaith conferences, and Dulles and the rest of them, together with what was called the National Council of Churches, and it had been the Federal Council of Churches and part of the World Council of Churches, we're using these terms. I mean, they wrote it up, and I have it in some of my books in Time Magazine, where they're talking about we need a world government. You know, we need this common faith type of thing that John Dewey had written about in 1934. John Dewey authored that book, A Common Faith, where he said dogmatic religions would have to surrender because they were developing this this philosophy, faith, ethic, morality, whatever you want to call it, that we all have in common. And so this has really been in the works for a long, long time, and it's, as you said, a spiritual element. And at the heart of it, behind a lot of these things, is this sort of occult aspect to it that Alice Bailey had written about, and Annie Besant before her, and Krishnamurti was supposed to be their new, you know, guiding light, the reappeared Christ, and so on. And before her, Madame Blavatsky, and it goes on back. And it linked up with political aspects to it. The Illuminati was trying to undermine not only a kingly authority, but religious authority as well. So there's been an attack and assault upon religion for many, many years. It takes different forms. Some would call it a new age, and others would call it a watering down of traditional biblical teaching. But spirituality is a really important part of it. And in one of my upcoming articles, I'll put about how there's been called, there's been a call for a United Nations of Religions. If you think the UN has done, you know, a bad job...
Hold that thought there, Dennis. We'll be right back in just a moment to wrap up the program. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest has been Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and we could go on for about another 3 hours, but of course we're going to have to call an end to this. And Dennis, thank you so very much for being with us. Appreciate it, and hope we can get you on again next week or sometime real soon.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Thank you so very much. And again, Dr. Dennis Cuddy, if you'd like, of course, to read his articles on newsreviews.com, we carry his book on mental health screening. That's Mental Health Screening, available from Radio Liberty, a pamphlet on mental health screening. We carry his book, Cover Up, and certainly we recommend his material, Road to Socialism, which we carry, timeline to a new world order for education, an extensive chronicling of this whole long-range plan by an elite, a very wealthy and powerful elite. Behind them are the powerful spiritual forces, which I describe in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. If you have not yet read it, let me recommend it to you. That's Brotherhood of Darkness. And, Chris, you can get the book, you can get the DVD, you can get the VHS, you can get an audio tape, or you can get them together in the Brotherhood of Darkness special. We hope that many of you will want to get the information and certainly get Dr. Cuddy's information as well, and then help us disseminate the truth out across America. I do want to mention that we do carry the Berkey products. If you need a big Berkey or Berkey Light and you get one through us, why, you'll get a free video or four-tape set that we produce. And then, of course, I want to mention my talk on world revolution, because it will give you insight into how it is that very, very powerful people have been behind this whole movement to bring about world communism and world socialism, financing these things so we would have an enemy to rally the people against. And, of course, the classic book on that is Foundations, Their Power and Influence, written by Professor, written by Rennie Wormser, who was the counsel for a congressional committee that investigated the great tax-exempt foundations, Rockefeller, Ford, Carnegie, almost 50 years ago. And they found they were financing communism and socialism. And, of course, if you want to bring it up to date, we carry the book Importing Revolution, going into how the Ford Foundation is funding this whole illegal immigration movement, LULAC and Moldavan, so many of these groups of Mexican nationalist organizations that are helping the illegal immigrants. Why? Why? Because, of course, they want to change our culture. They want to make us a multilingual, multicultural society. They want to destroy America because their loyalty is not to the United States, but to this internationalist dream. And behind that are the powerful forces that energized Henry Ford. And that's all covered in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and explains why Henry Ford financed the Nazis, because the rationale was they were anti-communist. But then Henry Ford financed the communists and built a massive a plant, a Ford Motor plant at Gorky in Russia. So why would Henry Ford finance both the communists and the Nazis? Well, you'll find the answer in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. And, well, we're out of time. This is the time when we need to remind you Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. We hope many of you will want to join the Radio Liberty family. And remember our webpage, radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for revival. But please remember to pray for our provision and for our protection. And so, till we're together again, may the Lord be with you. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not the illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. Hopefully we're going to have on the line with us very, very soon Mr. Barry Shamish. And Barry is certainly one of our favorite guests. He has written extensively about the murder of Yitzhak Rabin, the premier of president of Israel. In fact, he has put out some wonderful videos on that and has lectured all over Israel, all over the country, about the fact that Rabin was murdered just exactly like John Kennedy was murdered. Of course, it was an operation of the Israeli intelligence. But, of course, things began getting a little dicey when Barry Shamish began talking about the murder, the assassination of Ariel Sharon. And with that as the background, is Barry available? No, I guess we're waiting to try to get him on the line. So we'll hope that our producer can get Barry on the line. But Barry, over in Israel, feels very strongly that Ariel Sharon was murdered as well. That is not uncommon that they will murder key people. And unfortunately, here we have Barry Shamish coming on in just a moment here. Barry actually was involved in a very strange automobile accident recently. In fact, the Israeli police wouldn't even let Barry see his own car. And then he had a stroke. He had a severe injury. And of course, tremendous pressure was put on him to silence him. After all, when you're leaving in a country and you have evidence, or strong evidence, that the head of your country has just been killed by people associated with the intelligence agencies, why they make it very hard for you. And so Barry has come here to the United States. And Barry Shamish, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
Well, why don't you just tell us a little bit about your why you had to leave Israel?
Look, I just got very, very suspicious after a while that my number's up. It began with a stroke, and I admit, come on, I smoked. Anyone knows me knows I smoked. I was still too young to get it. But I didn't let it bother me. I said it's possible. But then came a whole bunch of awful things. I'm in court day and night, paying fortunes for garbage suits, harassed on the internet. I can live with that. That comes with the business. But then comes another accident where I don't know what happened. I really don't know what happened. I know I was, I think, crossing the street. I saw some lights, and then I got smashed 23 days in the hospital. And the Israeli hospitals are not nice. They don't treat you nice. And I just said, that's it.
And about your car? Was there something about the car?
No, they just hid it from us.
They hid your car from you so you couldn't get hold of your car?
Not nobody. Not my insurance company, not my lawyer. The police didn't invite me to be interrogated. I just disappeared.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, we've got Barry with us, and Barry's here in the United States now, and we hope to have him as a frequent guest on our program. We'll be back in just a moment, because Barry has some of the most incredible stories you've ever heard. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Barry Shamish, and certainly Barry is... are you an Israeli citizen or an American citizen?
I'm not American.
All right, fine. He's an Israeli citizen then.
Yeah.
But he speaks very good English. He's there frequently, and we consider him a good friend. He's been on the front lines of trying to expose what's going on over Israel in Israel, because Israel is being betrayed by its leaders, and this is what the average Israeli can't understand. I mean, we expect here in America that our leaders are to be dedicated to America and maintaining the sovereignty of our nation, in just the same way that the people in Israel think that their leaders are dedicated to the preservation of Israel, and then they keep doing all sorts of stupid things, giving away more and more land, and giving away 90% of their land and 95% of their land, and then giving away Gaza, and now pulling all the settlers out of the settlements there. So you pick up the story, Barry.
Okay.
People don't want to hear me talk. They hear me talk all the time.
Okay, number one, I think it should be stated that I didn't get into a lot of trouble until I started tracing the murder of Sharon. And let me tell you something. The doctors went on TV in Israel a month ago, a show called Uda, and said, "We're so sorry, but we killed him." Sharon was detected with something called CAA. On November 18th, when he was brought into the hospital, the doctors found out that his brain vessels were weak. So, do you know what they did? They gave him a great prescription, Texane, a blood thinner. These would explode into a cerebral hemorrhage within weeks, and they knew it. They prescribed, now why they did this, okay? I have got the nation's leading, how would we say it in English? The drug czar is writing me and saying, what the... You think they didn't know what the Kexane was? They gave him a killing drug. They gave him a blood thinner. And then I started tracing this more and more. He was drinking tea with Shimon Peres in the Knesset when he had a collapse. And who brought him into the hospital? It was Yoram Rubin, the man who murdered Yitzhak Rabin. It's the same killers at it again, the exact same team. And then it gets even worse. Because this is a leader of a nation, no less. They tell him to go to the desert, to his farm, his ranch, in the Negev, without a doctor supervising him, without anybody supervising him,
poison. This is the premier of Israel. We'll be back in just a moment here with Barry Shamus. We explore the strange death of Sharon. All right, fine. So Barry was basically telling us that, first of all, Sharon had he must have had some sort of a transient stroke or something. They gave him a blood thinner that, of course, would predispose him to a stroke. They told him to go off to the desert without any medical supervision. Now, this is the premier. He is the president of Israel, and you would think that everything would be done to preserve and protect his life.
Nope. Everything was done to make sure he died. He should have stayed in Jerusalem. His blood should have been checked three times a day. He should have had doctors he should have been under supervision. They let him go alone. And who was the last person, now watch this, who was the last person to see him alive before cerebral hemorrhage? It was Ehud Olmert. He saw him at 6 o'clock tonight. He had his final hemorrhage. He wanted papers allowing him to be the prime minister the next day when Sharon underwent supposedly a minor operation. Sharon signed them with a warning. Ehud Olmert left the house, premier of Israel, the next day, and then he went down. Then Sharon went down. The two people who saw Sharon for the very last time were the number one and two candidates for the leading Kadima party. It was Olmert and it was Shimon Peres as usual. They knocked him down.
No, no, of course, why would they do that after all?
To become prime minister, to gain power.
So you think it was really all mainly a coup d'etat to replace your own?
It was. What do you think it was?
I'm asking you, because actually...
Of course it was. What was the Rabin assassination? It was a coup d'etat by Peres. It was a takeover. He did it again with Sharon.
Well, it would appear that Sharon was pretty well going along with the internationalist
agenda. It doesn't matter. Quit thinking like that. These are people who want power.
All right, okay. And so,
okay, and they got power. They're number one and two in the country right now.
Okay, and so basically, after you had suggested that maybe that there was some skullduggery with the death of
Ariel
Sharon, why then things really began falling apart for you. Is that when the lawsuits were lodged against you?
Look, pardon me, what was the question?
You mentioned that you had had a number of lawsuits. You had to go.
Oh, it's just endless. The guy who hit me, believe it or not, is suing me for deliberately hitting him. The whole thing is a fiasco. And I can't live in Israel because, frankly, I won't live. I don't think I'll survive it. I really don't. But let me explain. I'm in America, and I'm giving my lectures. If these fail, I will go back to Israel. There's no choice. Please let me give my email, and let me give my phone, and maybe anyone who, like tonight in Mississippi, had a marvelous audience. Come and invite me. Tonight I did the horrible war, the secret war against the settlers. Tomorrow night, by the way, I'm doing, and I'd like to talk to you about this, the Vatican. That's where Paris comes into all this. The takeover of Jerusalem by the Vatican. Okay? These are my two main lectures. I'm also doing Rabin. People still want Rabin. My email address is Chamish, Chamish, at NetVision. That's one word, NetVision. .net, NET.IL, Chamish at netvision.net.IL. I have a phone, but I hate it. I got jipped, but nonetheless, 303-304-5025. That's 303-304-5025. If I don't succeed at this, I'm going back to Israel. I'm telling you, they're going to do nasty things to me. That country is nuts.
Well, let's go a little bit for our listeners who really don't know too much about the politics of Israel. I mean, a lot of people think that, of course, that Israel's running the United States, which is really so ridiculous, because I always like to say, if the Zionists are running the United States, they're not doing a very good job as far as Israel is concerned. America is doing everything we can to force Israel to cede land. You know, they've ceded most of the land that they controlled.
And, indeed they have.
And, of course, now... It's, but why don't you get into the background of the strange death of Isaac Rabin, because that is a story that is so incredible. And the video that you have... Do you have copies of those videos with
sure.
you?
Sure. I mean, write me at that address I just gave you. You can have them. I'll arrange them. Remember something important. This is now known in Israel. There was a tremendous upsurge on the 10th anniversary last November. There was a poll in the Ediot Ahronot. Half of Israel's Jews assume it was a conspiracy. Okay? Just know that. But nothing can be done. Nothing. I succeeded with Rabin. I guess they got scared that I'd succeed with Sharon. Because it's the same murder with the same gang. And I guess they panicked. All I know is my life started turning lousy, and I started thinking to myself, something is really wrong here. I listen to my stroke. I used to have a beautiful voice. Now I have to force it. And you should see me. I don't look the same. It's not the same Barry anymore. I said, this is it. I'm getting out of here. While I was in the hospital, I said, I'm getting out of here. Now, let me explain the big one, and that is Shimon Peres. The minute Kadima was elected, do you know what his first diplomatic act was? He flew to see the Pope. Paris flew to see the Pope. Now, something remarkable happened not a few months ago when our government sent our president, Katsav, to the Pope to negotiate the handing over of admittedly a small amount of land on Mount Zion, but complete hegemony goes to the Vatican.
Now, this is something I hadn't heard of. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this? They're offering some land up there on Mount Zion for our
you
listeners.
You don't know this.
Mount Zion is just adjacent to the holy city, you know, just a few hundred yards away from there. So, how large a place are they planning on giving the Vatican?
They think, again, it was a litmus test. That's what it was. They want to see what the role of Israelis would be. And it's the size of a room. Okay, they claim this was the room where Jesus was he either resurrected? No, I do believe he was crucified. This was the
It wouldn't be the crucifixion site, because that's at least theoretically is inside the city, or
yes,
the city over there by the Jeremiah's Cove.
No, you know, it was the Last Supper. I'm so sorry. It was
okay,
the Last
fine.
Supper room.
All right, fine.
So they want to get it back from this yeshiva, the Asper yeshiva, and they have a very simple deal. Israel will give the Vatican this land, and the Vatican will give Israel a church in Spain. Now, this is nuts. I mean, what real countries negotiate for such a crazy deal? We'll rent it to you. We'll lease it to you for 99 years. But you don't make a half-cocked deal like that where you actually give away your land to the Vatican.
Now, basically, of course, what you're saying, they would actually cede sovereignty of the land to the
Complete.
Catholic.
All right. Now, this was no surprise to me. And if you've read me well, I did the whole Paris deal. Paris offered the Vatican. Okay, first of all, just know, in May of 1993, Paris offered the Vatican the old city of Jerusalem, all the way to the airport. And this wasn't just mildly received. This was published in, first of all, in Shishi. There was an interview with Mark Halter, the person who delivered the letter. Then in La Stampa, the Italian magazine, who explained that Arafat accepted this deal because the Vatican agreed to give him a state capital within their little enclave. But it gets even worse because in May of 1995, Arut Shever printed the actual cable from the embassy in New York to the foreign ministry, Shimon Peres' foreign ministry in Jerusalem, and the next day that cable appeared in Haaretz, a very, very radical left-wing newspaper, but it appeared on the front page of the Friday edition of Haaretz. Peres was found out. He handed over East Jerusalem to the Vatican. That's what he was doing. And now, did he have to pay for this? Of course not. He's second in the Kadima. He's the second most powerful guy in the country right now.
All right, of course, from the Christian point of view, that has a great deal of significance because it's...
Well, from the Catholic point of view,
right.
Was Christian. From the Catholic point of view, it has plenty to do with it. He's handing Jerusalem over to the Vatican.
Well, I think that is, of course, rather a frightening thing, especially at this time. But why would Peres do something like that? I mean, this would appear to be a total betrayal of the Israeli cause.
He doesn't care about Jews. He doesn't care about Israel. Look, I wrote a book called Shabtai Tzvi, Labor Zionism and the Holocaust. I've covered the Labor Zionism. Labor Zionism was never, ever devoted to Judaism. They hate the Jews. Look, I've gone over this. If there wasn't Labor Zionism, there would not have been a Holocaust.
What we're talking
about are people who work with the Nazis on something called the Transfer Agreement. This was brilliantly recorded in a book called The Transfer Agreement by Edwin Levy of the Chicago Tribune. This is serious business.
And what you're suggesting, of course, is that this group wanted the Holocaust because they wanted them to force the
yes.
Jews to go to Israel.
They wanted the German Jews. They made a deal to get the German Jews, as many of them as they could, to Israel, and then the British cut off the borders of Israel. And they got their German Jews. They got about 70,000-80,000 of them. And that's all they wanted. They were as racist as the Nazis about who they took in. And then came the Holocaust. They did everything possible to make sure every single Jew died in Europe. If you know anything whatsoever but what was done to the Hungarian Jews and why Adolf Eichmann was finally arrested from Argentina, why Raoul Wallenberg was executed on the orders of the Jewish Agency in Jerusalem. The people who knew the real story was that the Jewish Agency was not trying to save one of 800, well, they tried to save 3,500. That's how many Kastner, his name was Rudolf Israel Kastner, negotiated with Eichmann to save 3,500. Eichmann said, we'll save them all, give us 600-700 trucks, just a few things to move things out of Hungary, and you can have all your Jews. Well, I don't want to touch them.
Hold up. I'll be back in just a moment.
Right.
Well, Dr. Stan, our guest is Barry Shammas. Now, let's get a little into this story because it's, I want to make sure I understand this. Now, certainly there was this gentleman. He was a Swiss diplomat, as I remember, who had actually saved a lot of the Jews. So, were those Hungarian or Romanian Jews you'd saved?
Look, the best book is Perfidy by Ben Hecht. That'll open your mind to the trial of Rudolf Kastner. Kastner was sent by the Jewish agency to supposedly negotiate the freedom of Hungarian Jews. He was offered all 800,000 of them by Eichmann. He turned them down, took 3,500 pals, and that's it.
And the name of the book again is Perfidy?
Yes.
And by Hecht?
Yes.
Is it still in print?
Yes.
All right, fine. Well, and this really tells you the story of what happened then.
Yes. It tells the story of the trial of Malkiel Greenwald. He was the journalist who accused Kastner of betraying 800,000 Jews. Now, remember who knew what was going on. Eichmann and Wallenberg. Now, Eichmann, he was the only Nazi ever convicted by the Jewish state. The only Nazi ever tried and convicted by Israel. How do you explain that? There were tens of thousands of Nazis to arrest and convict. Only Eichmann was tried. They put him in a glass booth so he wouldn't open his mouth, and they made sure that story of the Hungarian Jews never got out. As for Raoul Wallenberg, only the Jewish agency had the motive to kill him. This business that the Russians killed him, what for? They didn't even know him.
And so you think that he was killed to keep him
quiet? Of course, he was killed by the Jewish agency. On their orders.
And, of course, this was because he knew that they could have rescued a lot of the Jews,
he
and there
saved,
were people who didn't want to.
He saved more Jews in 1 week than the Kastner did negotiating with Eichmann. He was a good man. And this is where you have a very, very serious problem, that the Jewish agency, which ruined Zionism because they threw out the Jabotinsky Zionists. They threw out Menachem Begin. They threw out Shamir. The good guys with the Zionist right. And I was on an Arab show yesterday trying to prove to these people, you could have made peace with the Zionist right. They were good and they were honest people. But you got stuck with the labor Zionists and you didn't have a chance. Not a prayer.
Well, of course, the tragedy, you know, we have this ongoing tragedy in the Holy Land between the Palestinians and the Jews, and it looks like there really is no logical solution to it at the present time.
I assure you, there was excellent solutions in the 1920s. There was someone named Jacob Dahan. He negotiated a peace with the Arabs. The labor Zionists had him killed. They had him killed in 1923. Right now, the Arabs are too filled with hatred.
Right.
And I told them on the show, guy, you've got to stop screaming Palestinians already. This is getting obnoxious. Okay? Every word I said, he was screaming Palestinians. You have to understand that we are being set up to cause a regional war. Both of us. It's worldwide. The main parties of the Council of Foreign Relations in Manhattan and the Vatican, they are setting us up. And if you don't stop screaming at Israel, we're going to get absolutely nowhere. If you both realize what we're being set up by the world powers, we might have a chance to fight our way out of this mess.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back with you, Barry, in just a moment.
Right.
Well, Barry is really talking about the fact that there is the labor Zionists who are really the enemies of those people who aspire to Jewish principles and ideals, and they've done everything they could to sabotage a peaceful agreement between the Palestinians and Jews, and of course they've been instrumental, you know, in making sure that an awful lot of Jews got killed in Europe. Why? Because out of the Holocaust would come many Jews streaming into Israel and not knowing where else to go, wanting to get away from Europe. And of course, that was really the major impetus for the setting up of the State of Israel, wasn't the Holocaust?
No. Only 100,000 Jews survived. What are you talking about? They killed everybody. This was Chaim Weizmann's big worry. Chaim Weizmann, leader of labor Zionism, he said the idea was to save 2 million, not to wipe out everybody. No, look, the Holocaust, Israel was formed in spite of the Holocaust, not because of it. And I think what has to be understood is that, now look, this is tricky. I admit it's tricky. But Peres and his Gang of Labor Zionists are working with the Germans again. Now get ready for this. Can you imagine that Germany believes that Jerusalem is their capital? Because it's true. In 1906, a new cathedral was put up on Zion Square, on Mount Zion. It stands today. It's called the Domitian Abbey Cathedral. It's a direct copy of Charlemagne's cathedral in Aachen. This is my second lecture. It was put up on the highest spot in the city in 1906 to make darn sure that Germany got its Holy Roman Empire of the Germanic nation back. And this is extremely serious. I don't know how deep I want to go into it, but let us just say they are working on getting it back. Now, with Charlemagne, United Germany, the Muslim nations from Morocco to Iran declared him King of Jerusalem. He'd never been there, but Jerusalem was Germany's capital. It's that simple. And by the way, in 1222, a German king, Frederick Barbarossa, took over Jerusalem and made it king, and made himself King of Germany from Jerusalem. And this medieval nonsense is known to the German rulers, certainly not to their people. And they are they're not going to let a bunch of Jews sit on top of Mount Zion when it's their city. This is what they believe. Okay, now I can go to the depths of what putting that church up meant to them. Did you know that now get this, 1898, Wilhelm, Kaiser of Germany, is in Jerusalem. And you can only imagine what a terrible trip that must have been for him. Do you know who's beside him?
No.
Ready?
Who was beside him?
Theodor Herzl, father of Zionism. What were they both doing in Jerusalem in 1898? Look, all the history books say this had to be the most dramatic moment in both histories, to take a tramp steamer to Yafo and climb up that hill by donkey. Nobody did that. It was extremely important to establish that Germany had a new capital, Jerusalem, and who was there? The father of Zionism. All we're told is that he was rebuffed. We're told in all the history books that he was rebuffed by Kaiser Wilhelm. Rebuffed from what? It was Turkish land. The only way Wilhelm could have got a Zionist state would be to declare war on Turkey. And he didn't do that. Now, this is a fascinating story. It's the building of a new German empire whose capital, and by the way, it's the capital of the Vatican. Never forget that. Charlemagne united Germany on behalf of the Vatican. They want it back. These maniacs from Germany want it back again.
Well, now, do the average person in Israel have any idea of these things you're talking about?
The average person in Israel can suck its little lollipop and die, because that's what's being set up for them. When Judea and Samaria go, Israel's going to be bombed by rockets from Lebanon, from the Gaza Strip, and then from the east, which means downtown Tel Aviv and the airport are just going to be flattened with these things. And I'll tell you something else. My son doesn't want to fight the Israeli army because he's going to be asked to throw Jews from their homes. I wonder how many other tens of thousands of young Jewish boys feel the same way. We're finished. We're in big trouble.
I know, of course, the difficulty is that, of course, the Israeli army was used to force the settlers out of Gaza.
And who wants to serve in an army like that?
I know.
Okay,
well,
it's horrible.
Well, I think that the important thing is to determine who really runs the Jewish state. And I don't think it's a Jewish
state. Well, movement. I told you, it's the Council of Foreign Relations. It's the Vatican.
Hold that.
They're the ones manipulating the Jewish state right now.
We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Barry Shamison. And Barry certainly has been on a crusade for a long period of time to try to wake up the people in Israel about the fact that they're being betrayed by the leaders. And certainly he led a lonely fight to convince them that Yitzhak Rabin was killed. He was murdered. It was not at all the story they'd been told, but it was an intelligence operation. And apparently he succeeded fairly well. Recent polls suggest that about 50% of the Israelis realized that Rabin was killed. And, of course, more recently, when Sharon was done in, why, of course, is he went on a campaign to point out the inconsistencies of the death of Ariel Sharon, and certainly at that time, apparently, they really came after him, and his life has been rather miserable since then. So he's here in the United States and talking about some of these incredible things, and the fact that the Vatican has been offered space, or actually a room. I've actually been in that room, the so-called Last Supper room on Mount Zion. I don't think it's where the Last Supper was held, but it makes a great story. But it's a beautiful room, a very prominent building there on Mount Zion. And this would not simply be a room that the Vatican could use. They would have sovereign authority. In other words, just as the Vatican in Rome is a sovereign society, sovereign state, and the Italian government has no authority over it, so the same thing would happen as far as this property on Mount Zion. I never heard that before.
Well, let me tell you, number one, I'm going to do this, give my email again, because if I don't get speaking dates in the United States, I go back to Israel, and they are going to make toast of me. And I'm not exaggerating. Chamish, C-H-A-M-I-S-H, at netvision, one word, N-E-T-V-I-S-I-O-N dot net, N-E-T dot I-L, and 303-304-5025, helping out this way. I need work. Next. They didn't just offer Israel a church in Spain. It's beyond just a trade-off. They want the whole thing. It was a litmus test, and they found out something. The rabbi of the yeshiva phoned me up. He actually phoned me up, said, what should we do? He wanted me to show up in his study hall because the minister of tourism was planning to come the next day, and he wants to show them a really thick, exciting study hall. I said to him, are you out of your mind? Haven't you learned a thing yet? If you block this minister of tourism from coming near that room, I'll show up.
Hold
but
that,
I'm sure
hold,
not going to show up.
Hold that thought.
The proof room, you've got a great study hall.
Well, my friend, our guest this evening is Barry Shamison. And Barry was just saying that, who was this who was actually asking you? Was
the rabbi of Diaspora Yeshiva, Rabbi Goldstein, where the room is housed.
Okay, fine. And, of course, then but what was this about the Minister of Tourism?
He was coming to make a report the next day. So they had a great idea. We'll fill our study halls with a few more people. I told him, you block him. You stop him physically from going in anywhere near that room. That's what you do. I'll participate in that. You cannot. These are the worst enemies of Judaism, is the Israeli government. You don't cooperate with them.
All right, and of course it's unfortunate, but the wicked people apparently have really taken over.
Yeah.
And all one has to really do and look at it objectively, I mean, why would Israel cede, you know, about 90 to 95% of the land that they'd actually taken after the series of wars, and why would they cede that to the Palestinians? Didn't
Again,
make sense.
Again, it's the business about the Frankists, the Sabbateans, the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, Gaza, went religious. These people hate religion. And I can't tell you how much they hate religion. When the Jewish settlements were first started, nobody thought they'd succeed. They thought the Arabs would kill them. And the next thing you know, you've got 300,000 people creating a great society. And it was taking over Israel. So it had to go. That's number one. But in going, you've got the borders. You've got the 1948 borders being exposed again. We cannot fight missiles from Lebanon. We can't fight them from the Gaza Strip. And we sure as hell won't be able to fight them coming straight out of Judea and Samaria. we're back to 1948 borders where one out of every 100 people in Israel died trying to defend that state. This time, the Jews will flee. And I told this Arab on the radio show, congratulations, the world powers have made sure you get the victory.
And, of course, it's so very difficult, I think, for the average person here in the United States, or even for the average Israeli, to believe that there are other forces in the world.
Why is that so difficult to believe?
Well, because most people have their own preceived ideas, fixed ideas. I mean, they believe our government is loyal to America, that they want to preserve our sovereignty, that we're over...
Are you sure about that?
No, of course not.
I mean, I'm asking a question. What American, with any sanity, would say it was good for a young American boy to die bringing democracy to Iraq? Who in their right mind would believe that?
But they see there are a lot of people, Barry, that are not in the right mind, and they believe what they're told by their leaders. And you get somebody like Congressman Murtha, who I think is a very courageous man. He's been being demonized. He's being called senile. He's being called, you know, unfit to wear the Marine uniform. How dare he say we ought to get our boys out of Iraq? And you'd be amazed at how many people go along with that.
Well, just remember, I interviewed Ron Pundak. Ron Pudak was one of the two negotiators of the Oslo Accord. Shimon Peres had nothing to do with Oslo, nothing whatsoever. He brought in the Vatican. I interviewed Ron Pudak, who told me the idea of Oslo was Israel without borders. There would be no borders in the Middle East. We would have one gigantic block. And that's what he told me way back in December of 1994, and they're doing it beautifully. At the same time that the United States is raping Iraq and Afghanistan, Israel is being torn to bits. And that's exactly what the plan always was.
And I really fear that the plan is to destroy Israel. I think there's no other logical explanation for what's going on today. And I think an awful lot of Israelis are going to die, not having any idea that they're being betrayed by their leaders.
Just remember, half the world's Jews now live in Israel. And they're being corralled. And it's 1941, and we've got a wall. And that wall is not to keep Arabs out. It's to keep us in. Everything's the same. There's no difference.
It's like the Warsaw Ghetto, isn't it?
It's a giant Warsaw Ghetto. Half the world's Jews could be wiped out. That's how serious it is.
Well, let's get a little bit into Sabbateans, because I don't think most of our listeners have ever heard of Sabbati. In fact, you know, the first time I ever heard of Sabbati, I said, well, I'm going to check that out myself, and went to my Encyclopedia Britannica, and there it's all a whole big section about a man named Sabbati, who formed a new sect, and of course that sect has still a powerful influence within the Jewish community today. So you pick up the story of Sabbati and the Sabbateans.
Sabbati wasn't just influential. Most of the world's Jews in the 17th century believed he was the Messiah. It was one of the most profound episodes in Jewish history, and yet it's forgotten. Everything profound in Jewish history is somehow forgotten. Well, let me tell you, on June 18th, 1666, he declared he was the Messiah, and Jews all through Europe sold their properties, a penny to the dollar, climbed on mountains and expected to be transported to Jerusalem. If you can believe this insanity. But the Sultan of Turkey, you know what? I'm going to give you an amazing hit. You have only till Tuesday. Hurry up. Go to IsraelNationalRadio.com. Go to Tamar Yonah's site. It's an amazing interview with Dr. Marvin Antleman. He'll give you the full background of Sabbati Tzvi. Sabbati Tzvi was forced by the Sultan of Turkey to convert to Islam. He did. Most Jews became distraught. They abandoned him, but not all. There was a sect in Turkey called the Donma, and they believed that it was a message from God that we too must enter other religions, Islam and Catholic primarily, and destroy them from within by remaining Sabbateans. Now, the Sabbateans believe that Judaism is wrong. it's the opposite of Judaism, which is right. And once again, you take the Ten Commandments and do the opposite, you can be mighty busy at a lot of nasty, nasty work. That's what they are. Now, the big meeting, the giant meeting, was in Frankfurt, Germany, when the king, well, the head rabbi of European Sabbateans, his name was Frank, Jacob Frank, met at the home of Mayor Anschel Rothschild, Adam Weishaupt. In 1785, the conspiracy to end all conspiracies met. Now, as for Rothschild, they just wanted money. And the conspirators, the Illuminati, the Jesuit Illuminati, and the so-called Jewish Frankists all agreed to help Rothschild spread his banking interests, while at the same time, the Illuminati would destroy Protestantism. That would be it. They wanted one religious ruler, the Pope in Rome. The Jews wanted Judaism destroyed, and any Jew that didn't accept Shabbatsky as the Messiah deserved to die. This horrible, horrible conspiracy has been ruining our planet for the last 250 years, and I don't know if we can ever stop it.
Well, of course, Rabbi Antelman, is Rabbi Antelman over in Israel at the present time?
Yeah, well, he's always there.
All right, fine. And so basically, he has been researching this for a long period of time. I know he wrote a book I read probably 20, 25 years ago, something about...
Oh, no, it's longer than that. He wrote it in 1974 to eliminate the opiate.
Right. Well, time passes when you're fast when you're having a good time. That would have been, what, 30 years ago.
But he turned out to be right.
All right. Well, tell us a little bit about, now, how do these people influence what's going on today? And this is
they
the Sabbatean...
They started Israel. They started Sabbatean state. Look, the people who started Israel were miserable sons of bitches. I'm telling you that right now. They were bad people. And there was a very, very good Zionist movement led by Jabotinsky. They got rid of it. Completely through trickery got rid of it. Israel was founded, I'm going to say it again, not to be a Jewish state, but to be an anti-Jewish state.
I think I'd say that one more time, because I think that's such a heretical idea. And yet, of course, you look and see that everything is being set up to destroy Israel and destroy all the Jews in Israel. Maybe that makes a lot more sense.
I want to tell you something. The neighborhoods where they live, Sahala and Savion, they've never been hit by a terrorist bomb. Never. Let me put it this way. Israel was founded by Sabbatean Jews who had no desire to found a Jewish state. They wanted an anti-Jewish state. And this was the fact from the beginning. And now they're doing all their dirtiest work. They are going to wipe out Israel. If somebody doesn't stand up very, and I mean now, when Judea and Samaria goes, the whole state will be in 1948 borders. It can't survive. It can't.
Well,
it will better make it survive.
Well, certainly, Samaria has been turned over to the Palestinians, hasn't it?
Samaria largely, but once again, the settlements with the magnificent views, the highest settlements are where the Jews live. And let me tell you, you replace them with Arabs, and Israel is not protected anymore. It's finished.
And of course, they would then use that as a center for attacking the surrounding parts of Israel.
That goes without saying. Look, everything that anybody said about the Gaza, the Gush Katif withdrawal, all came true. They are smashing Israel with rockets. And I'll tell you, one of these days, something's going to happen at that Ashdod power plant, and there's going to be a major tragedy from what was Gush Katif. Gush Katif, all the wonderful farming, 25% of Israel's produce, all lost to the economy. The Palestinians, so-called, can't make a carrot grow in there, but they sure can shoot missiles. And that's what they're doing. And the Israeli government, of course, has no interest in making them stop. They enjoy the missiles.
And you know, the most amazing thing, Barry, was that, you know, of course, when the Jews were forced out of Gaza, and when the military, the Israeli military, went in and you know, just simply arrested and dragged the Israelis out of their homes in Gaza, then there were a group of very wealthy people who put up a lot of money so that they could give it to the Palestinians, so they could use the greenhouses and the farms and all the land that the Jews had actually, you know, developed there, because this was a very, very productive area. And apparently, nothing's happened, you know.
It was productive because the Jews of Gush Katif were extremely productive people. You're not going to make the Arabs of Gaza productive people. Okay? They don't even think that's going to happen. But they will shoot rockets at you.
But, of course, the trouble is there's so much hatred today, you know, on the part of the Palestinians, you know, and there's certainly hatred on the part of the Jewish people for the Palestinians.
I got news for you. There should be a whole heck of a lot more than there is. The Jews will take any deal, and no, I tell you, I have met many so-called Palestinians. Their hatred is much, much more than the Israelis. Much, much more.
Well, there's no question at all that there's this intense hatred, and I don't know how you're going to solve the problem.
Well, for one thing, the old solutions were probably the best ones. The old solutions were that Israel actually enforced itself, actually set up a military state to defend itself. And that was not a bad solution. Now, to set it up so that you returned to the 48 borders is not a very good solution. You're right about that. But just 10 years ago, 15 years ago, Israel actually had the high ground. Okay, and by the way,